So I vividly remember the concept of landing is really obviously different for a seaplane to land on the water at whatever speed you're doing when you touch down compared to a helicopter where, you know, you zero speed and hover and you're putting it on the ground. So the concept of touching down on the water at that speed for me was just so uncomfortable. I was slightly nervous about where we would end up. I remember being planted in the back of my seat thinking, this is not quite right.
Well, that's a familiar voice. G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 67 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. On The Step is all about float planes and flying boats. To get in contact with me, my email is dan@thatmallardguy.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and send me a message at @thatmallardguy. Did you recognise that voice at the start? We shall find out who it is shortly, but before we jump into this episode, it is time you did it, folks. It is time you took your next big step in your life. It is time for you to leave me a review. 5 stars, of course. Now, you love this podcast, I know it, so say thanks, come on. Spotify or Apple Podcasts, rate the show, it really helps me out and it is much appreciated. Also, don't forget to tell a friend about the show. Share the love, folks. We all love our niche little industry within aviation, and the bigger and better it gets, the better for everyone. All right, enough of the suspense. We are jumping straight into this episode today, folks, because it's a big one. This guest has been one of my most requested for the show so far, and don't worry, I told her all about it too, so she felt the pressure, but she delivered. It's my wife, Jenna. Jenna's story is a cracker. It's a story of career changes, adventure, experiences, and breaking the number one rule that you set for yourself: don't date a pilot. I'm certainly glad she broke that one. Jenna was once a helicopter pilot, but is now the business manager of the Mallards iFly. Yes, 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 that makes her my boss. I get it. But she's a great boss. Well, really, she's a leader because she does a great job at what she does. And I'm so proud and excited to have her on the podcast. Let's get to the chopper. Flying across the turquoise waters of the Whitsunday Islands, en route to Whitehaven, we'll step out of our angry palm tree onto the silica sand of Australia's number one beach. Sipping on champagne in the shallows, we'll stare curiously at the sky as the sound of a beefy radial engine gets louder. Observing the floats attached below, we'll watch it descend to water height, touching down, cooler than a helicopter, on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A lot.
Alrighty, welcome to On The Step. A very special guest today, folks. Qualified school teacher, helicopter pilot, helicopter instructor, and now business manager of the Paspalie Aviation Mallards. Welcome to my wife, Jenna Bolton. How are you going?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to start our interview with a little bit of a story from the other day, actually, and you know, you had caught me daydreaming, as I do many a times around the house, and like any lady does, I asked their husband, "What are you thinking?" Hoping for some sort of romantic answer, and unfortunately, I gave you an answer like just thinking about how I was going to introduce you on your episode of the podcast. You said, "Oh, well, what is that? How are you going to do it?" And I thought, "Well, actually, I think I'm going to introduce you by saying, first of all, thanks very much for putting up with the last couple of years." And I think you said to me, "Putting up with? What do you mean putting up with? How about supporting, you mean?"
And I was constantly.
Like, yeah, I was like, yes, supporting, I guess. But there was a lot of, you know, putting up with at times, you know, me saying, "Oh, I've got a podcast." Bloody podcasting, geez. But then I thought about it a bit more and I thought, you know what? And to give a bit more background for the listeners, obviously we live here in Darwin in a very pretty small 3-bedroom apartment. Everyone probably know if they're a regular listener that we do have a couple of kids, now, to a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old, Finn and Charlie. They take up our other spare rooms. So I don't have a dedicated area for podcasting. I've built myself this little kind of one-seat table, portable table with a big box around the top of it, which I've stuffed with soundproofing foam, and I call this my podcasting booth. Now, this podcasting booth lives in our bedroom, doesn't it? You have to stare at it every night. It's got that Mallard Guy logo on the side of it that I've tried to play around with. It's got a couple of aeroplanes that sit on top of it, some model aeroplanes. And at times, I have to arrange these interviews to move them in a different locations around the house. Some examples are in our shower, in our laundry, sometimes in our kids' rooms when we kick the kids out and kick you out to the balcony for an hour and a half while I talk aviation with people. So I have to admit, you are right. It is a lot of support. You're there lifting me, helping me lift this contraption around the house and moving it to location so I can talk aviation. So I think I want to start the episode by saying a huge thank you to you, Jen, and I think the guests, all the listeners as well, would back that and say thank you for the support you give me and the show. How's that for an intro? Was that good?
Pleasure. Sounds like we definitely need a house.
Yes, we definitely do need a house. That's another topic and another podcast episode that we're going through dramas with at the moment, but we'll save our listeners from having to go through that. Anyway, that is probably one of the longest intros I've done for any guest. We've got the kids asleep at the moment. They're both asleep, hopefully, at the same time for a couple of hours so we can have a good chat about your career and the interesting things that you've gone through in your career. And I've had a lot of people requesting you, actually, to come on the show, as I've mentioned.
That's a bit of pressure.
Bit of pressure, yeah. As I have mentioned a few times, your history. But let's hear from you yourself. Take a step back into the beginning, because I know that it wasn't anything to do with aviation that got you on track. Tell us about the start.
From school, I went to university and then finished my Bachelor of Education, and I only taught in Australia for 6 months in a beautiful little country school with kids who'd ride motorbikes on the weekend and just loved to be outdoors and amongst it, and it was a fabulous 6 months. But then I decided that, you know, I was 21 at the time and was kind of more interested to get out and see the world, so I decided to go and teach in London. And so I got a working holiday visa and went over there and spent 2 years working for 6 months, traveling for 6 months, working for six, traveling for six. And then I decided that I wanted a bit more stability and focus on career rather than just flittering about enjoying myself. So I decided to get a permanent job based in London. So I kind of taught the next 7 years based in London, right in central London, which was just absolutely fabulous. Completely different world to Australia, certainly in Darwin, but I really enjoyed every aspect of it.
Tell us about that school, because I know there's some pretty interesting stories. It's a bit weird actually interviewing you because I know all the stories. But yeah. Tell us about the school you went to and some of those interesting stories about some of the families that you had, for example, who would try and get into the school.
Yeah, so it was a private boys' school, non-faith dominated over in England. It belonged to quite an exclusive group of schools, so we attracted very high-end parents who would actually ring up in the delivery ward of a hospital to register their children to go to our reception pre-prep schools. Obviously, you're not allowed to register a child before they're born, so we would get phone calls literally the moment they were born to put them on the wait list. So it was highly sought after, but it was exceptional. Like, majority of the time, I think the first few years I was there, I had a class of about 12 boys with a teaching assistant, and then the maximum I had was probably about 18 boys, again, with a teaching assistant to support all the way through. So the quality of education was through the roof, and the clientele that you attracted were very driven children. So we were doing things like complex fractions with six-year-olds, just stuff that's really unheard of in the normal education setting. So it was a real eye-opener to certainly a different way of doing things and a different standard that education revolved around, but it was just amazing.
Yeah. And one thing I remember you always saying that, because I was like, oh, wow, that's an incredible story. Like, you must have been, you know, some incredible teacher, and I'm sure you were, but I'm that's not where I'm going with the story. But, like, I kind of felt like that you would have to be some super experienced and down some specific high-end teaching route. Obviously, you can tell I have no teaching history. It wasn't really the case, was it? Like, you kind of got the job just off a couple of years of doing the teaching and traveling, like you said. And
yeah, absolutely. So a friend of mine worked at the same school, and she said, you know, Jen, there's this teaching position coming up. I think you should apply for it. And so I put in my CV, and I studied hard for probably a week to 2 weeks before my interview. And I was really nervous. I was suited up. And I got there and I met the head teacher, and we sat down on couches, and he said, so tell me about home. And I kind of looked at him like, is this a joke? Is this some kind of, you know, pre-interview informal chat before we get to the serious stuff? And the whole interview was more about the person you are and your outlook and approach to everything rather than your formal qualifications and I suppose educationally your background, etc. It was more about how you'd approach different things and what you like to do and what you bring to the classroom. So the whole interview went that way, and then you have in classroom assessments where you have a board of people sitting at the back of the room watching you interact with the children and teach a lesson. So it was certainly not what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a much stricter, formalised process. But, yeah, I was certainly lucky the way it turned out.
And one of the other perks about being around, you know, this very exclusive group, I guess, of people was the fact that potentially you're able to do some tutoring on the side and some experiences through tutoring I know that you had were very incredible, like, you know, travelling. And I mean, a lot of the listeners to this podcast are probably overseas, closer to places like Europe. But from an Australian perspective, you know, me hearing these stories originally, hearing things like you would go off to some chateau in France for, you know, a long weekend just to do some tutoring with a family. It's so different to what we expect in Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the education system is very different, especially in the UK. So we were in a pre-prep school, which is up to seven-year-olds, and then from there they go on to a prep school. And so when I taught year two, we were prepping them for their prep school, and a group of, say, 200 boys would sit exams, and we're talking formal exams, an hour-long English exam, an hour-long maths exam, reasoning, and then formalised interviews at seven to go then to a selected prep school. And so 200 boys would sit for the possibility of perhaps 20 spaces at their school. So it was highly driven, sought after. You had to be the very cream of the crop to get into some of the schools that some parents chose for their children. And a lot of it over there is granddad went to that school, so dad went to that school, and now the expectation is that, you know, the son went to that school. So it's a high pressure on a seven-year-old to perform at those, to get into those highly sought after places. So there was a significant amount of private tutoring going on as well for across the board, not just at our school, multiple other schools, to get ready for those exams. So very quickly I was approached to do some private tutoring, and it kind of started at just one lesson maybe after school, and then it built to another day, and then towards the end of it I was doing, you know, multiple afternoons after school, and then all day Saturday. So I would literally go from one family to the next. I probably only did four or five families, but it was probably 8 hours of tutoring, private one-on-one, which is fabulous. Like, the quality of learning that you get one-on-one is amazing. Yeah. And so, yeah, I'd just go from family to family. I'd like had one family on one side of Hyde Park and then another on the other. So I'd finish there and then run on back through the park to tutor some other family on the other side. And that's what I'd do all day Saturday.
And I guess the tutoring will come more into the story in a moment as well when we talk about trying to raise the funds for your next venture.
Yeah.
But tell us about aviation. I mean, you've grown up, and I know, just taking a step back as well, you know, your mum was a teacher for a long time, pretty much her whole career. So teaching's a bit in the blood, I guess. But where does the aviation part of things kind of fall into place here? Because, you know, you've gone overseas, you're starting to build yourself up as a really, you know, well-qualified and exclusive teacher, you know, primary school teacher with this tutoring on the side there. How did helicopters come about?
So I can't definitively tell you a point in time where I started to be drawn to aviation, but it has slowly built up and built up and built up. And there was a defining moment when I was in London. I used to tutor this boy who had this penthouse right on the River Thames, central London, absolutely spectacular, looked up and down this incredible river system. And for anybody who knows London, helicopters are quite restricted in their flight paths in and out of London, mainly in and out over the River Thames. So I'd tutor this boy on a Saturday for a couple of hours and the helicopters would just be back and forth and back and forth. And while I was sitting there tutoring maths or, you know, creative writing, I'd look out the window and think, wow, that's something that I really am drawn to, you know, just the freedom of it, the excitement of it, the variety and what these guys are doing. And so it kind of just built up and built up and built up. And at some stage in the last couple of years I was in London, I just thought, you know what, it's kind of now or never. I either go home and I try something else and I can always go back to teaching, or I, you know, continue down this education path. But if I don't try, I'll never know, and I don't feel like I can get over this whole helicopter thing. It's kind of encroaching on how I think day to day. So I've just got to jump on board and go home and try it out. One of the main reasons I went home to Australia is because the weather in England isn't particularly great for flight training the way that I wanted to do it. You know, if I was changing careers, I decided that I wanted to do it in quite a fast manner so that I was out the other end and I could start back in the employment pool. I think I was roughly, well, I don't know, maybe 27, 28. And so I kind of decided that the training and education aspect of it had to be condensed so that I could get back in the employment pool and start building a career in aviation instead.
It's funny you mentioned that, the aspect of getting the license done very fast, because I know that you did it in about 6 months or so, wasn't it? It was very fast that you ticked off the license. But relatively, for someone changing their career, you know, after they've had, you know, a reasonably good chunk of their career so far in the one industry, 6 months is really nothing, isn't it? Especially, you know, when you've saved up the money. I mean, you've got one of your best friends did a full doctor's career change, you know, and it was like 7 years or something like that. It's ridiculous at your age as well. So
exactly,
I guess that 6 month process is not really long compared to most other changes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're all in aviation. We know the concept of, even once you get your ticket, it's just a ticket to start learning, really. And that was a steep learning curve after that. But to be out the other side and at least starting that progression into aviation jobs and learning more commercially was definitely what I wanted and why I wanted to accelerate it.
Yeah. Tell us about your initial impressions of helicopters. Was, You know, was that everything that you kind of imagined when you started flying yourself from, you know, looking back at those River Thames moments of helicopters flying down the down London there? Or was it something a bit like, oh my God, this is, I'm never going to be able to do this type thing?
It was probably a mixture of both. I look back and I cringe at the questions I asked some helicopter companies because I was just had no realistic knowledge of the industry. And so I was like, do you think I could be a search and rescue pilot? And to their credit, the schools that I asked those ridiculous questions to were very patient in explaining there's a long way to go between starting your license and, you know, being a rescue pilot or an offshore pilot or whatever big dreams I had when I had absolutely zero understanding of the industry to start with.
And what about those actual flying lessons though? Like, tell us about, you know, what it was like when you first took the controls of a helicopter and, you know, like hovering for example, because I was so lucky to spend a bit of time with you in the control seat of a helicopter, which we'll probably talk about later on, but it's certainly a difficult thing to fly straight away, isn't it? It's not like jumping in a 172.
Yeah, and it's like an out of control bumblebee. It's so frustrating that you think in your head, oh, I can do this. And, you know, little movements have big effects. So I'm just going to approach it in a certain way. And then you get in the helicopter and the helicopter doesn't do what you're thinking it's going to do in your head because your hand is doing something incorrect or your feet are doing something incorrect. So everything goes out the window and then it's a complete wake-up call to your actual ability. You know, you can't have any ego or any preconceived notions going into it. One of my instructors would often say, just look out the front and fix what you see. And your head is going 100 miles an hour because you think, my left hand should be doing this, my right hand should be doing that, my feet should be doing this. But in the end, you just have to look out the front of the helicopter and use small inputs to fix what you're actually seeing, not over critique every aspect of what you're trying to do. So it was the first probably 20 hours, I think, while you're trying to get your head around what each control does and how it moves and the small inputs that you have to put into it. Those 15-20 hours are very steep learning curve.
You obviously did a good job because you finished your full commercial license within 6 months, which is a pretty incredible feat, really.
I think that's more my instructors than anything else.
Oh, obviously dedication, and you know smashed it out. There's as you mentioned, a huge learning curve. I remember you telling me stories about things like, you know, just learning how an engine works. Like, you didn't really have that type of, or the mechanical background before you jumped into this, hey?
Exactly, it was probably to my detriment in the beginning, just how little I actually knew about the whole process and everything you have to know when you become a commercial pilot. So the extent of my engine knowledge was you turn the key and the engine starts and off you go. Whereas obviously you have to know the engine backwards and how it all works, et cetera, et cetera. So I was super lucky. The training school that I chose for a couple of reasons, but one in particular was that they had a engineering workshop there so that they were doing maintenance on the ground, and B, the instructors were real world pilots as well as instructors. So they all flew for Westpac Surf Rescue. They all flew for the news helicopters. So they were in and amongst the industry and happened to instruct as well. So that experience and knowledge base was super beneficial for actually giving me on the ground real world training. In every aspect, flight training, engineering, and God, some of the engineers, I look back and, you know, for an engineer working on a helicopter to have a student come in and ask really basic questions must have been incredibly frustrating, but they were just so patient. I mean, one in particular just took me under his wing, and he was so incredible. He used to stay at the hangar until like 8 o'clock at night explaining the, you know, how the engine worked or the angle of attack on the blade and how it moved. And he just had all the time in the day for helping me understand and be better at what I was doing, which just, you can't put a price on that level of assistance.
No, I think also that when students show that interest, people will naturally spend the extra time to, you know, teach these things if the party is interested. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not something that most people will just do generally off the bat for people who are not interested. So obviously you showed a great keen interest to learn, which is what people love to see in any industry, really.
Yeah, I'd like to hope I was keen and enthusiastic.
I think you were, by the sound of it. One thing that I've always heard from you in the past about your initial times in aviation was that the potentially that the industry is probably well known to be a little bit more male dominated, which is probably changing a little bit these days, which is a great thing. How did you approach that whole process with trying to stand out a bit more in your own way?
The girl factor is a bit of an interesting element to me. I was raised by very strong parents, but a very strong mother in particular who always worked. So I wasn't ever really conscious that it's a male-dominated industry or a female-dominated industry. I just expected to be treated like everybody else. Like, you should be judged on what you bring to the table and your merits and your attitude and how you do things and your skill level, not on any other factor. And that's how I treat every situation. It's got absolutely nothing to do with it. Don't get me wrong, there were definite positives and negatives, and I can see the positives were definitely that you probably get a few more opportunities because you are different to the norm. But I like to think that I also got given the opportunities I did because I made sure that I was doing things in the correct manner and I was, you know, in there and dedicated and trying to be useful but offer more on the table than what your, you know, other pilot next door would. In saying that, I probably worked out very quickly that the only two things that you can really be judged on is your attitude and ability, obviously, but also the knowledge that you bring to the table. And if I was going to get over any stigma that was associated with any gender differences, then I was going to be the best at what I could control, and that was my knowledge base. So I spent a lot of time making sure that I knew as much as I could possibly soak in. You ask me a question, I can answer it, or I'll go away and find out the answer. That aided, I think, the opportunities that I was given. But I was also around incredibly supportive pilots from the very beginning, you know, like not only the instructors and the engineers that I worked with to training, but then in my first couple of jobs in particular, people really went out of their way to keep me in check.
Yeah.
And make sure that I was still critically analysing where I was at and getting better and better and better.
Yeah, well, tell us about those first jobs and what was it like to actually get, you know, you've done that career change, you've done the study required to have that qualification.
Yeah.
How did you go out about trying to find that first job and what was it in the end?
So one of the other reasons I chose my training school was that it was associated with a commercial flying activity. So my school had a base on Hayman Island and a base on Hamilton Island. And both of those bases had a very strict 500-hour minimum. They didn't look at anybody under 500 hours, which I probably didn't realize the significance of when I was training and getting ready to go into the workforce. So I finished my license and I went up to Airlie to meet with the CEO, and I turned up to his office every day, all suited, looking the part, like, ready, I'm desperate for a job, want my foot in the door. And I turned up every day and he wasn't available, and so I'd go back to the hotel, and the next day I'd do the same, suit up, go in, hope that he was there and available and ready to talk to, and get that, no, sorry, he's too busy today, you know. So I'd go home, and I think it was on the Friday, after 5 days in a row, I'm sure he was probably like, just bloody let her in, that he actually had time to sit down and talk to me. And I was unbelievably lucky that, you know, all things lined up, that they were looking for an operations manager, base manager on Hayman Island. And so he said, what we're going to do is we're going to flight test you. You get through the flight test, you can have the base manager position on the ground for a year. Then we will flight test you every 3 months. If you pass every flight test, at the end of it, we'll give you a line pilot position on Hamilton Island. And so I just thought I'd struck gold, you know, like to get a look into a company that historically hadn't ever employed, you know, 110-hour pilot in particular, but to be given a position where I could learn more on the ground without the stress of being thrown in the deep end of actually taking people, paying people in the helicopters, yeah. But get my head around it all commercially and start to build up my knowledge base of how it works and, you know, the whole entirety of the system, and to be given flight checks every 3 months was, to me, absolutely gold. I couldn't have asked for more. So I skipped out the door and went home and packed my suitcase of things and went up to Hayman Island, this tiny little rock in the middle of the ocean.
So you spent a year on the ground running operations and, you know, trying to get your head around how helicopter operations as a pilot would work. And, you know, tell us about some of the stuff you learned in that process there.
So I was completely naive to anything commercial. So even the concept, the basic concept of, if you fly from A to B, you've got 30 minutes to do it, you should do it in 0.5. For me and my training, I was always that little nana flying around at, you know, 19 inches at, you know, 80 knots. And that's more than fast enough for me, not realizing probably that it was ticking over my time.
Yeah.
And in a commercial world, that's just not acceptable. You have to, you know, pull max continuous power and you fly from A to B because that's your job. So that aspect of it was a whole different element. The other aspect that I learned very quickly was you don't actually make money from dead leg. So you fly a helicopter from A to B with nobody in it, then that's cost the company. On my first week there, I think I was sending every helicopter out to do multiple trips everywhere because they could just drop off passengers and then come back empty and then go back at the end of the day and pick up passengers. And within the first week, the general manager rang to say, so we don't actually do it like that because you have just doubled the time on the helicopter, but for not any extra revenue. And that was kind of a light bulb moment to be like, oh, this is actually a commercial operation. It's not just, you know, flying around this idyllic with Sunday islands for fun.
Yeah.
But the pilots I was with just were some of the most incredible people that I think I've come in contact with. One in particular was really hard on me. Don't get me wrong. They were tough. Every tiny little aspect of everything I did, helicopter-wise and organisational-wise was critiqued, and critiqued hard, but one helicopter pilot in particular. So the deal was that I could have as much ICUS of flying with another pilot in command as I wanted and the pilot agreed to, or any dead leg that I could fly by myself without passengers for that first year. And so the pilots were amazing in the fact that really they gave me a lot of flying. But one in particular was very adamant that the whole time I had to improve. So his deal with me was that I had to do the daily inspection, get it out, fuel it, get it ready, which I'm sure he then would check afterwards. But then he would ask me a series of questions, and they range from law-based questions to mechanical questions to you name it, he would think of it. And so he'd ask me a range of questions. And if I got one wrong, I wasn't allowed to fly that day. I was ground bound, and I'd, you know, storm off down the road and get my head back in the books and come back tomorrow. But if I got them all right, then I could, you know, do the day ICUS flying with him. And so that concept in itself made me hit the books so incredibly hard, because I knew that my knowledge was the difference between having to sit on the ground all day or getting to go out with this other pilot and fly people around and go to the most beautiful beaches in the world, or go and snorkel on the reef, or, you know, get out and actually fly and be in the helicopter. So I worked really hard, and there were a lot of days he would come up with just complete chestnuts of questions that would completely throw me. And it was, you know, something that I'd never even thought of before, and he'd stick to, nope, you didn't know it, so you can't fly today. And so that made me a better pilot. And so I probably got, over the course of the year, I probably got 150 to 200 hours flying.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so it was incredibly generous of an experienced pilot to take me under his wing, rather than just treat you like a junior pilot and, you know, your job's on the ground, get back in the office type situation. So.
Yeah. And then how was the upgrade after that year of sitting on the ground? What was it like to then go over and join, you know, the main group of pilots on Hamilton Island and start, you know, being let loose by yourself and starting to fly, you know, all these passengers around by yourself? That must have been an incredible moment.
Oh, totally. It was the culmination of working so hard for the year to then be let loose and actually start what you want to do was just brilliant. Like, I just absolutely, the last day I got on that boat from Hayman Island over across to Hamilton Island, I think you couldn't wipe the smile off my face. Like, I was jumping on that boat and I was on cloud nine. But again, you know, they put me on Hamilton Island because there was probably a group of maybe 15 helicopter pilots. And they put me on Hamilton Island with that group of 15 because there were other people constantly around all day to, I use the word critically analyze. It probably wasn't that formal, but critique, really.
We'll just offer advice, have a chat about stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So
as pilot groups do.
Yeah, if your landing wasn't great, if you were coming in too fast, if you know, there's a whole range of things that you should know at the beginning of your career that you have to build up that knowledge base to get to that understanding. And those pilots there certainly helped me get to that position.
So on Hammo then, obviously this is a seaplane podcast. I know we've had a lot of requests about having you on the show, and the story's going to be amazing either way.
Yeah.
But Hamilton Islands and the Whitsundays in general are also famous for their seaplane operations, aren't they? So,
yeah.
Did you ever notice the seaplanes at all when you were over there? I know you were in your own little bubble with helicopters, and there would have been just, you know, sensory overload of learning that you would have had to have gone through. But did you ever take a notice of, you know, the seaplanes and think about what they were up to and that kind of activities that was going on there?
Probably more so on Hayman, to be honest, because on Hayman they, well, you know, you flew there, so
yeah,
you know better than most. It's slightly different because you come up the ramp and you turn around in the main marina area and everybody stops to watch the seaplane. And then the takeoff is right out the front. So the seaplanes were a large aspect of the day-to-day interactions on Hayman Island. Whereas on Hamilton, because you take off from the runway, I probably didn't consciously think about them as much. Yeah.
So I guess that comes to the next part of the story, and that is, as you mentioned there, the at the time it was Air Whitsunday who were operating out of Hayman Island, and that was literally me.
Going up
those ramps many times.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think as part of my wedding speech at our wedding, I think the first line was, I still remember the first time that I actually met you, and that was sitting on the floats of a beaver or a caravan at the top of the Hayman ramp there, all shut down waiting for my passengers, and then I see this lovely young lady driving a golf buggy, because it's all golf buggies over there, driving around the back of the from the main terminal or the main resort past me to the hangar, which was where the helicopters were kept. And I gave
did you
a little...
just describe me as a lovely young lady?
Yeah, lovely young lady. this is a PG show, obviously.
Yeah, thanks, Granddad.
I gave a little wave, and I think you gave this beautiful big smiley wave back, as I'm sure you were. Everything was happy about Jenna on Hayman Island, you know, as we just heard, you know. Anyway, that was the first time we met, and then we got to know each other through aviation. Once you started flying on Hamo and doing your visits over to Airlie Beach to get off the other rock that you now had moved on to, and then we started dating a little bit as well. And we went on a pretty amazing adventure as a bit of a first date, didn't we? You took myself and one of your best friends, Kylie, the person I mentioned before, who changed careers to do medicine. Tell us a little bit about that little first date-ish type thing that we did on the choppers.
Yeah, we did. We cross-eyed a helicopter off the company and just spent the day going from Little Bay to Little Bay, snorkeling, lazing on the beach, eating picnics, going to Whitehaven Beach and swimming in the beautiful ocean there. And then we went back to Hayman Island and had lunch by the pool, and we kind of had a nautical themed adventure in the Whitsundays, which was incredibly
lavish.
Lucky. Yeah, it was ridiculous looking back at it, but I like to think that's how I hooked you.
Yeah, I think so. I was definitely that. Yeah, that was funny, the nautical theme. I dressed up as a sailor basically, and we looked pretty funny walking down the Hayman Marina dressed up as sailors, just flying in our own chopper. And then we finished the evening parked up on Pinnacle Point watching the sunset about 1,000 feet up on one of the islands this top little spot. Hey, that was an incredible little landing area, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. So Hook Island is in the middle of the Sundays, and there's this tiny little collection of flat rocks, really, at the top right on the pinnacle. And on really calm days, kind of wind less than 10 knot, kind of days, you can put a helicopter on the top and it's just 360 degrees of just incredible scenery from all the way up and down the mainland just to all of the little islands dotted around the Whitsundays, and to watch the sunset from up there is pretty special.
Yeah, that was an amazing spot. And then I guess, you hooked me with the helicopters, then I got to take you out on the Beaver and take you for a flight around the Whitsundays and kind of show you what I do. Do you remember that trip that we did, and what was your first impressions of
being
on a seaplane, I guess, if that was the first time you were on one?
So I vividly remember the concept of landing is really obviously different for a seaplane to land on the water at whatever speed you're doing when you touch down compared to a helicopter where you're zero speed and hover and you're putting it on the ground. So the concept of touching down on the water at that speed for me was just so uncomfortable. I was slightly nervous about where we would end up. I remember being planted in the back of my seat thinking, this is not quite right.
Yeah. No, well, you're right though, aren't you? Because like you didn't have any other real aviation experience. So like you're obviously on big planes before and everything like that, but you're looking at the back of a seat. Whereas this one, you're looking at the front and getting the same picture, which you've now become accustomed to, flying helicopters.
Yeah,
but
for
you're
sure.
now coming in and sliding along the water.
Yeah,
super weird.
It's very, very different.
But we had a snorkel and at the reef and had another picnic on the beach, and I guess the rest is history, is what they say, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we spent the next kind of couple of years floating around the Whitsundays, and then you moved off the rock and were given another pretty incredible opportunity to get into helicopter instructing and combine that teaching background with helicopter flying. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, so after I'd been on Hamilton, I think I was probably on Hamilton for a couple of years, the original guys that taught me to fly were based on the Gold Coast, and they asked me if I wanted to do my instructor rating, and I hadn't really, it wasn't really the path that I was going to take. I always wanted to be an offshore pilot. So I thought, education background, I really love flying. Maybe that is a next step, and maybe that's a possible avenue that I can go down. And the concept that those guys were also flying different things, not just instructing, was a huge appeal as well. So I thought, yeah, that sounds like a great next step for me. And I'd met this bloody pilot who kind of threw a spanner in the works, and I was dating a seaplane pilot, which I adamantly, when I got into aviation, I was like, I'm never dating a pilot. Nah, completely off the radar, not interested.
Pilots are weird, but seaplane pilots, they're pretty cool.
They're terrible. but my main reason for not dating a pilot was, A, because you're tied down to an industry which is really difficult, and B, for me, I just didn't want to lose any credibility by starting to date people that you work with. So I was really conscious of that. And unfortunately, this seaplane pilot happened to get under my skin, and I was like, I'm kind of, I like this guy a fair amount. So I don't really want to move away, because if I move away, then it's done and dusted. So I went back to my boss, the original CEO, and I said, hey, I've been offered this job. I'm on the Gold Coast. They're going to give me my instructor rating and, to instruct and fly other jobs, but mainly instruct down there. But I don't really want to move away. Is there any chance that you could, be interested in what I've got to bring to the table instructing wise for you? And he said, yeah, absolutely. I'll give you an instructor rating. I'll fly you down to the sunny coast. You can do your instructor rating with this master of helicopters, Graham Gillies, and you can come back and you can instruct here. And then every now and again, you can go back to the island and fly the turbine helicopters out to the reef and, fill in there when needed. And I thought, this is amazing. Like,
that's not how you get a job in aviation.
Someone else is willing to invest in me to get another job. This is just out of this world, incredible. So I signed on the dotted line, and he sent me off to get my instructor rating on the Sunshine Coast with Graham Gillies. And Graham is this larger than life, very prominent figure in the helicopter instruction world in Australia, for sure. He's just this incredible person who has so much knowledge to impart on you. So I was just so looking forward to starting training with him.
But a bit nervous as well, though, wasn't he? Because he does have as much of a gentleman Graham is, he has a bit of a reputation in the helicopter, doesn't he?
Absolutely. So everybody I talked to, I went into the engineering hangar in Airlie, and I was like, yeah, I'm going down to the Sunshine Coast to, become an instructor with Graham Gillies. And their reaction was one of horror, really, to be like, really? You're doing it with Graham? Oh.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Like, you don't need to be on your game. And I was, my elation went to really quite nervous of what I'd got myself into very, very quickly. And I, again, decided that the only way I was going to get out of this situation and come through this instructor rating with this master of instructors was if I knew as much as possible, and there was no hesitation in my knowledge bank at all. And so I just threw myself back in the books and studied and studied and studied. And it was just a brilliant experience to learn from somebody who knows his stuff back to front and would really get the best out of you, really black and white, short, sharp, to the point, but there was often no need for anything else. It was, this is what I want you to do, this is how I expect it done, and if you did it that way, you were fine.
Yeah.
If you didn't, then it would be a different course, but, you know, he was fabulous in making me a better pilot for sure and a better instructor. So to use all of that, because I had a Bachelor of Education already, I didn't have to do the basic fundamentals of learning and that
the,
side
the
of
classic
it.
Classic PMI exam. What a great exam that is.
Yeah, so I just had to do the actual flying component and teach, obviously, be observed and teach lessons in the classroom, but not the theoretical side of education. So it was really thrown in the deep end and let's get it done. So, yeah, it was fabulous.
And then as you mentioned there, you got to fly 44 down to do the training in that aircraft and then flew it back up. And on the way back up, you'd had your instructor rating, so your seaplane pilot boyfriend was able to jump in the right seat, I've got to think about that, and give you your first student experience. And tell us about how your seaplane pilot boyfriend went flying helicopters for the first time.
What a pain he was.
Painful in what way?
Every way possible. I think that the helicopter brings everybody back down to earth, I would like to think, and I think it did its number on you. All through our aviation careers, I have always had these people that I've just put up on pedestals and thought, you know, this person is just amazing. Their knowledge base is incredible. Their skill base is incredible. They just have it sorted. And so, for everybody who listens to the podcast, Dan is one of those really annoying people who just have this knack of finding really difficult things easy, which if you work really hard to try and master something and someone comes in and just does it easily, you build up a certain hate level for that person. And I think that's Dan.
Yeah.
So, you know, these people that I'd put up on pedestals, very quickly, anytime they had any interaction with Dan, would be like, oh, this guy's amazing. His skills are incredible. He's such an incredible guy. And I'd be in the background like, what? I've worked for like
I know
2 years
guy.
Really hard to like get any praise whatsoever from this guy. And he's just dishing it out to Dan. What? That's not fair. But your helicopter skills were exactly as probably what everybody else knew they would be, and Dan took to it like a duck to water, you know, to the point where I was like, you know, we'll nose turn around this whatever cone on the ground and would you like me to demonstrate for you? And Dan would be like, oh, no, thanks, I've got this. I'm like, oh, here we go. And sure enough, he'd picked up the helicopter, he'd nose turn around the cone and put it back down. A lot of it I'd like to put down to just fluke.
I like it that we're still talking about this Dan guy as if he's not in
this
conversation.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, that's very funny. That's bringing back some good memories of flying helicopters and your jealousy. I love that. That was really funny.
Yeah. brilliant experience. I mean, we got to take a 44 down to the Sunshine Coast for me to do the instructor rating. And then we jumped in stages back. I think we took about 3 nights to get back and we just stopped off.
One.
Oh, was it?
Yes. You love a good exaggeration to stories, but
I do.
At a cabin. It was cool, wasn't it?
It was very cool by a little river and, then flew back the next day. But to go back to your question about my aviation background, my family don't have any connection to aviation whatsoever. Like they don't understand any tiny aspect of it in any capacity. So I didn't come from a family where we have uncles or aunties who fly for Qantas or whatever. When we flew the helicopter down, my parents have a large property outside of Noosa, in between Gympie and Noosa, and my dad had said, yeah, Jen, I've cut you a helipad in one of the paddocks. It's all good. It's a little bit wet, so I've cut you in like a proper helipad. And I was thinking, That's pretty impressive. Thanks, Dad.
Before you go any further, you mentioned big property, but the big property is on a bit of a hill. So
a lot of it's not very
usable for normal everyday activities. There's
exactly.
some areas that are flat, but most of it's, unuseful hill forest area.
For sure, yeah. It's basically half a mountain and a few flat paddocks at the bottom. Yeah. And so when we flew the helicopter down, we got there and I was circling over the top of the property thinking, where on earth is this helipad? Like, he's supposed to have cut this big helipad in and I can't find it anywhere. And so we ended up just landing in a paddock. Mum and Dad come down and I'm like, Dad, I can't find your helipad anywhere. Like, where did you put it? And he was like, oh, I put it up on the mountain, on the edge of the mountain. The slope must have been, I don't know, probably, I can't even tell you in degrees, but the slope was ridiculous. Like,
yeah,
it's the kind of slope if you put your car on and your handbrake on, you'd be worried that it'd still roll away. So there was absolutely no way that a helicopter was going to be there. So we had to land, and then Dan obviously had to go up, get the brush cutter and go back down and make a proper helipad on the flat where we could actually physically keep the helicopter. So that's where it stayed for the week.
That was good fun.
Mm.
I think I ended up with about 30 hours of helicopter flying from backtracking, because obviously you did a bit of work in Mackay a few days a week as well, which was about a two-hour drive. And then so every now and again there'd be helicopters that need to go back and forth, and every chance we could I'd jump in with you and get the drills.
Relocate.
Yeah.
Yep.
It was pretty cool. So the next step was, and coming back to one of the reasons why you don't like to date a pilot, is that it's very hard to get jobs in aviation, isn't it? So when it comes to moving, you know, these weren't our forever jobs, as much as I would have loved to have stayed longer flying in the Whitsundays and flying tourists around Whitehaven and the Great Barrier Reef. That, you know, it was a small town and we wanted to progress our careers and everything, and we had to come to that decision of where we would go next and trying to move. And we were pretty lucky that we landed jobs together that would both progress our careers in ways up in Cairns, weren't we? And we
for sure.
Both went up there and lined them up and ended up getting them.
And looking back at it, it's quite remarkable that we were able to move on at the same time to the same city and further our careers.
Yeah.
And I know we thought we were incredibly lucky at the time, but looking back at it, it was quite a remarkable achievement to get the jobs we did. So between Airlie and Cairns, it's about an 8-hour drive. So once Dan and I decided that we were going to try for jobs in Cairns, we got in the car and we drove all the way up to Cairns for I think we had Monday, Tuesdays off. So Monday, Tuesday, Monday we were supposed to meet with chief pilots of a helicopter operation and a fixed wing operation. and then go through the interview process. And then I'm pretty sure you got the job straight away.
Standard Dan.
And yeah, Standard Dan. and the chief pilot that I was supposed to have an interview with wasn't there. So I didn't get to have the interview at all. So we kind of were going back to Ellie with you getting a job offer and me not even being able to speak to the company. So it was kind of a mixed emotions thing. And then the chief pilot rang and asked if we'd come back the next weekend. So this is a 16-hour road trip round. So I was like, yep, no worries. I'll be there again next weekend. So next weekend, we get in the car, we go all the way to Cairns. We have this interview with him. He offers me the job, which is fantastic. So then elated, we drive home, you know, yeah, we're finally doing this. Like, we're so lucky. And I went to the CEO and said to him, you know, of my current company, to say, you know, Dan and I've been offered jobs in Cairns and, you know, it's fantastic. It's really beneficial for us to step in the right direction. And I'm really sorry I'm going to go because I'm going to accept this other position. And he said, no, you're not. And I was like, what do you mean? I am. Like, I've been offered a job. So there's two companies in Cairns. One had only Bell helicopters, long ranges, jet ranges, and 44s. And the other had only Eurocopters, so 120s, 130s, beautiful, brand spanking new, gorgeous helicopters. At the time, I could only fly Bell helicopters and 44s. I could fly jet ranges, long ranges, but I didn't have an endorsement for anything Eurocopter. And so obviously I got a job with the Bell helicopter company. And my CEO said, no, you're not flying for them. And I said, well, I can't even fly any of the other helicopters for the other company. And I'm not going to fly just a 44 and not fly anything bigger. And he said, leave it with me. I'll get you a job flying for the other company. As it happened, we were going on a sailing trip the next day for, I think, 5 days in the Whitsundays, and you're in and out of phone reception. I would come into phone reception and I'd get a phone call from my CEO to say, yep, I've got you a job. You're flying with the other company. They'll give you a contract. And I'd go out of reception again and I'd come back into reception and I'd get a phone call from the original Bell helicopter company to say, I've just sent your contract through. Please, can you sign it and send it back? And I was like, uh-oh, this is not planning out exactly how I planned. And then I'd go out of reception again, come back into reception. It'd be the Eurocopter company to say, yep, Jen, the CEO's contacted us. We want you to fly. Here's a contract. And so now I had two contracts for both companies in Cairns, who unfortunately are situated on the tarmac side by side. So I'd somehow created this situation where I had to be very careful with not getting a bad name with one, because I was going to turn down one of them. And so it went on and on like that for about 4 days, in and out of reception, until I came back to shore and was able to sit down with the CEO and sort it out to, what am I going to do if I can't fly their helicopters? It's kind of a bit ridiculous accepting the job. And he said, don't worry about that. I'll give you a rating to fly the 120 and then you can go and it'll be fine. Which is, for a CEO of another company to line you up like that is quite remarkable. Like, hats off to him. He, the whole way through my career from start to now, he is a person that I really value. And so, long story short, I eventually accepted the Eurocopter position, which was better than what I possibly ever thought it could be. Yeah. And so we merrily skipped off down the road, or up the road, 8 hours, and then we're based in Cairns for some period of time.
Well, yes, exactly, because we thought that that was going to be a couple of years of three or four years of work there. We even bought a unit together and, you know, made ourselves comfortable in this beautiful new town. And then that bloody pilot, Dan, hey?
Yeah, bloody pilots.
Has to go and respond to an email about pilots required to fly caravan amphibs in Vietnam. And then turns out I picked up another job after 6 months.
Yeah, yeah. I think we were in our apartment all of maybe a month.
No, it was longer before. A few months, 3 months. And then I'd left you to go fly caravans in Vietnam.
Yeah, yep. So that was 6 months, the first contract, I believe.
Yeah, but there was a bit of a, like, I mean, when the company I was flying for, you know, I was kind of doing a lot of right-hand seat caravan IFR stuff on regular RPT routes, they call them in Australia here, regular public transport, which has now changed with the Part 91 stuff coming in. But one of the things, the issues with being a captain on those routes was you needed, I think it was 150 hours planned IFR, from memory, 120 or 150 hours. But you couldn't count the co-pilot time, so I was kind of like, only waiting out for these random charters in the caravans, which was the only plane I could fly at the time. So it was really taking a long time to get these hours up. And then,
oh, this is the company in Cairns. Yeah.
Yeah. And then this job came up and it was a bit like I wanted to fly overseas. I just got out of floats. So I wasn't flying floats at the time and I was missing it, obviously.
Hmm.
And this is an opportunity to do a 6 month contract, go to live in a different country for 6 months. It was all IFR command time on the caravan over there, brand new G1000 EX caravans. I was like, this is going to be incredible. And we'll do the 6 months. It'll be fun. And we'll come back to Cairns and continue marrying, you know, having a merry life. You know, we're getting married after the 6 month contract. We're engaged at this stage. And so I could only really do 6 months before I had to come back and get married. So it was all lined up perfectly. But, you know, I did that. And then they kind of said they want me back, and you know, we kind of discussed it and we ended up doing another 6 months, but this time you came over.
So after the end of the 6 months, then they offered you another contract, and we were only going to really accept if they came to the party with me coming as well, really. And I initially thought, oh, you know, I could do 6 months in Vietnam, like not working. I can just take time out. I've got a couple of thousand hours, so I should be fine to kind of take a step out of it for a while and come back, and it'll be an adventure. You know, I think you were originally supposed to work, what, 4 days on, 3 days off or something like that?
Yeah, it was more of a set contract. The first contract was more of a as per the work type thing with no set days off. And then the next one was supposed to be with an extra captain coming from Canada so we could run proper roster, and you know, you and I could every couple of weeks we'd be able to go to somewhere in Asia just to have 3 days together, you know, exploring. Yeah. And then come back and
flit around, have an adventure and go back. I thought, well, 6 months of that, I can do that. That's a brilliant kind of sidestep. Aviation can wait for a little bit.
Yep.
But it very quickly unraveled.
Well, 4 days into you arriving, I think the other captain unfortunately was hit by a car on a scooter and fractured his hip in four different places and was basically not able to fly and had to go back to Canada. And it was just Dave and I again. And we went back to the other roster. So
yeah,
we were pretty flat out.
Did that basically meant you're working 6 days on, 1 day off?
Type stuff, yeah. A random day off here, a random day off there.
Exactly, yeah. So it kind of went from this, like, let's have an adventure and travel around, to I was kind of sitting in an apartment a lot of the time by myself waiting for Dan to finish work and come home. And then the 1 day off, we'd go out and about and do things. But Vietnam is, for anybody who's been there, it's an incredibly beautiful place, but it's very fast-paced. It's very hectic. There's no sidewalks. There's no logical order to crossing a road. It is mayhem. As soon as you walk out your door, it is chaos. And you very quickly get used to it, but it's fairly intimidating to be there by yourself in that realm. And so I didn't particularly enjoy my 6 months of being a lady of leisure. So I had romantic notions of like, this is going to be great. I'm going to get pampered. I'm going to sit back. I've never had 6 months where I haven't worked to just be in the one spot and kind of, I don't know, as archaic as it is, like be the housewife. And I realized very quickly that I'm certainly not cut out for housewife material.
Yes.
One of the main activities of my day was going to the gym, which was just around the corner. And I very quickly worked out that the gyms over there are next level. The technology is just ridiculous.
So, this was a fancy gym.
Yeah, it was a fancy gym, yeah. Every machine had its own TV with unlimited whatever you wanted, basically. But I very quickly worked out that to watch a movie, you actually have to keep pedaling the bike, because if you stop pedaling, it stops. So I spent hours watching movies at the gym, just very casually pedaling an exercise bike.
Oh, that's a funny story.
Yeah.
Yes, it was, and unfortunately, the weather that time of the year over the summer, Australian summer, must be the top end of the Vietnamese kind of winter time, is very hazy and polluted. Yeah. And so it wasn't a great look, it didn't turn out to be how we wanted, but.
Yeah.
I still remember, actually, I think it was actually on our honeymoon.
It was, yes.
Getting a text message. Yes, pilots talking. I think it was like in the Californian hills somewhere. I think we stayed somewhere out there. Anyway, near kind of Yosemite somewhere.
Yeah.
And I got a text message from one of the pilots who was at Passpale, who flew with me at Air Dewitt Sunday, and said, look, there's potentially going to be a Mallard position coming up in the next few months. You should chuck your resume in. And this was before we'd even started this second contract. You know, this was still on our honeymoon in between the two.
Yeah.
And we kind of discussed it a little bit, and we thought about it and decided to go for it. And it was a long, drawn-out process, but, you know, eventually I'd got that job, and we did the move to Darwin, and unfortunately I'd kind of actually left you behind in Vietnam a little bit again, because you had made plans for your parents to come visit, which I'm still devastated about this trip. You got to do this amazing cave walking experience in Vietnam, which I was supposed to join you on, but I had to come pack the bags and fly back to Australia and start this job here. How good's dating a pilot, hey?
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah. And then, so you got that amazing trip, and then you eventually came and joined me. But we did it again, though, because the company that you'd worked with in Cairns had a base in Darwin, and they were happy to put you on here as well.
Yeah. So as soon as we worked out that you were going to go to Darwin, I contacted the company I used to work for, you know, 4 months before that, and said, oh, you know, we're now moving to Darwin. Is there any chance that there would be a position at your Darwin base? And he said, absolutely, Jen, no worries, you can start as soon as you get there. And I was just incredibly happy and grateful, and it kind of turned my whole last 2 months of Vietnam completely around, because I knew I hadn't made a mistake leaving aviation, and that I could go back into it, and there's a position for me, and I could just pick up and carry on.
So you did a bit of flying in the territory for a few months there. How did you find that flying versus, you know, the flying you'd done in other places?
The flying that I actually got to do in Darwin was really good. So I had a fairly new 130 helicopter, and my job in Darwin was to fly the corporate gigs, to fly the high-end, high rollers, A to B, and do instructing on the side. So I taught people to fly in 44s, but I also got the opportunity to teach a couple of Tiger pilots how to fly the 130, which was this brilliant, random experience that nowhere in my lifetime that I thought that I would be given. And it was certainly an eye-opener into a different world of aviation and flying and how they approached it. And yeah, it was a different experience for me, that's for sure. So majority of the flying I actually did in Darwin was brilliant.
Yeah.
The other, and so a lot of it was film jobs, etc., which I love. The other half of that, there is a little undertone in helicopters in the Northern Territory, which can be perceived as a little bit cowboyish. A lot of the flying is mustering based, where that notion of cowboyish standards comes from. So I was a little out of my depth with just roll a 44-gallon drum over there and refuel out of the 44-gallon drum. I weigh all of about, on a good day, 52 kilos. And so for me, the concept of just rolling a 44-gallon drum of fuel over to the other side and refueling out of it was like quite horrific, because there is no way that I'm physically going to be able to do that. So that side of it was a different aspect to aviation that I hadn't really been involved in before. You know, you fly out the East Coast, you've got either refuelers that come and refuel you, or you're refueling out of proper fueling systems where everything is set up and ready to go and you just take the helicopter and put it beside it, basically. So the outback side of it, I wasn't, and I, to be honest, I don't think I'm really cut out for. So that kind of led me down a path where I thought, it's probably a great chance. Now that I've got a few thousand hours under my belt, it's kind of the right time for me to go in a slightly different direction career-wise, so that I don't become a line pilot forever.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but for having a family and the bigger, larger picture, you know, when you picture yourself at 50, you're not necessarily going to be a line pilot. So I wanted to go down a slightly different avenue, and this job at Paspaley popped up, and it was originally for a commercial development and operations manager position, which obviously, because I'd done all of that work on Hayman Island, I fit a lot of that bill. And so I said to one of the pilots, do you think I could maybe apply for that position? And he was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, go for it. Put your CV in. I luckily got a contract a few days later.
That's awesome. And now here you are now, and that position has now developed into a business manager position. And now you've been doing this for about 4 years now, I think now. Four and a bit years.
Yep.
It's gone pretty crazy how fast that's gone.
What
is the kind of general role that you do now for Paspaley Aviation with the Mallards? And tell us about, actually, before we jump into that, tell us about the first time you actually were able to go for a flight on a Mallard and what you thought of the whole process.
So we have three Mallards, as probably most people know, and they are just stunningly beautiful machines. A lot bigger than what I was used to. You know, caravans are much smaller. A Mallard to me seems like it's kind of double the size. It's really imposing. And so I think it was probably in the first week I was sent out on the Mallard to understand the aircraft and what it does, etc., just on a purling run out to our pearl farm. And it wasn't a particularly great day, and the water conditions were quite rough. And so I'd been in seaplanes before, caravans, beavers, on floats, when the weather, looking back at it, was beautiful. And so this day was, we landed on the water and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to die. Like, we touched down at 80 knots, is it?
Yeah, something around that.
So you're going really fast first. Then you land on the water and all this white water just comes up over the windows and you can't see and you're bouncing off the waves. And I thought, this is not quite the experience that I thought it was going to be. And then it came to take off and I was sitting at a window seat, very, you know, patiently waiting in the back thinking, we're going to turn around here and, you know, point into wind and, you know, take off in that general direction. And we started accelerating and accelerating. And for a helicopter pilot, obviously, we've already said it's quite an uncomfortable position to be fast and still on the water. Whereas helicopters, you go fast, but you're in the air, so you don't have that. The reference is very different. So sitting in the back when you're doing whatever, 50 knots, 60 knots, 70 knots along the water, and you can see the pilots working and working hard, is one thing. But this one takeoff was a dog-legged takeoff. So we were absolutely hammering down one side and then turned approximately 90 degrees and started hammering down the other. I think it was at that point I thought, wow, these machines and these pilots are completely different to what any expectation or any preconceived notion that I had of what this job was going to be.
Yeah.
Just phenomenal. Like what the aircraft does and what the pilots are capable of doing is just quite remarkable.
Yeah. But you have been on a couple of trips now in good weather as well, haven't you? Like the first time we got to take the aircraft out of their comfort zone, I guess, of operating up on the top end, and we joined the 2019 Rathmines Catalina Festival in New South Wales there. Like the thought of taking the airplane that far was pretty incredible. And you were there as the host. I think you're about 12, maybe 18 weeks pregnant, I think, at the time. And there you were in the back of the Mallard there on some better days, I think.
And, you know, on a good day where it's beautiful, calm conditions, it's spectacular. But it also seems, from a completely novice opinion in the back, like this just relaxed, calm, easy flight control, landing on the water. It's on the days where the weather isn't so favourable, or there's a bit of chop or a bit of swell, or, you know, the wind direction isn't bang on the nose, that it then becomes the pilots working and working hard for it.
Yeah. Oh, it's a good fun aeroplane to fly, obviously.
Yeah.
What about the other daily-to-day stuff that you you know, that you do as business manager of Passepartout Aviation?
So when I was originally brought on, it was to develop the commercial aspect to the aircraft. So these three beautiful aircraft had only been used for our own pearling flights, so intra-company to all of our Pearl Farm and back. They're like the Toyota Hilux of Passepartout. And they wanted to bring in a commercial element to them and make them work more. And so I was brought in to initially do that and build up the charters. And as Dan, and you've just said, the cross-country expeditions we do. So to bring in that side. So I still retain that side of it, but what I do now as business manager is look after the engineering side and the AOC side. So on a daily basis, you could be out on the hangar floor inspecting parts for conformance, or in with the technical specialist talking through another EO that needs to get raised for the manufacturing of a part, to the, you know, re-employment or employment of new engineers, day-to-day scheduling of flights. It's so multifaceted, which I just absolutely love. That's what kind of makes me skip into work every day and out in the afternoon. It's the whole you can plan everything to within an inch of its life, which, let's be honest, I absolutely love. But it's every other aspect that comes into that that really makes it interesting. It's, you know, last week, for instance, we had corrosion on a piece in the tail that had to be pulled out and sent away. And then we had to raise an EO for the manufacturer of the new part. Then it had to come back and the sheet metal specialist had to put it all together. So you're constantly going through all of that steps with them while you're talking to charter clients about landing in Little Rivers or, you know, up at King George Falls. So you're trying to pre-plan all of that and get ready and be involved with pilot meetings or pilot training or a whole range of different things, which, you know, that's what keeps you on your toes and keeps you interested, is that it's not, you know, a 9-to-5 turn up. You do the same thing every day. It's every single minute of every day is very different.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm.
Awesome stuff. Helicopter flying now, I guess, for you is more of a private thing, isn't it? It's a bit more of a going out and about and enjoying it for, you know, going back to that Nana style of flying at 19 inches and 80 knots.
Totally.
And enjoying it for what it is. So have you got back into flying since you kind of stopped, and tell us any stories that you've got about, you know, jumping in a chopper and renewing that passion, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. So I very much now only fly for fun. And by taking all of the commercial aspect out of it, you can really just fly for fun. Do whatever you want, wherever you want, just for your own enjoyment, which adds this element in that is different to what it is when you fly commercially. So I'd had about, I think it was probably 12 months off flying, 12 to 18 months off flying. And we went back to the Whitsundays and we decided that we were going to take a helicopter out for the day. And I was completely uncurrent, didn't have a BFR. So I had to go back and, with the same original company CEO, have a BFR and tick all of those boxes before I could even get back in the helicopter. And before I got there, I was thinking, oh, I don't even know whether I'm going to be able to start this thing. Like, I'm going to have to go back to, like, your real basic, get out the checklist and follow step by step through it. But remarkably, it comes back like it was yesterday. You know, it's ingrained in you, your check system. If you have a flow, like I was pretty strict on flows of every check that you had to do, and so instantly you're around the helicopter, the daily inspection is complete flow from start to finish, and that all just comes back straight away. Get in the helicopter and it's like you haven't stepped out of it, which I found just fascinating, that it could be so refined in your experience that it becomes second nature.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we spent a brilliant day. I think I was about 6 months pregnant at the time. And we spent a brilliant day, like, out in these tiny little coral-filled bays snorkeling and going to Whitehaven and landing on the beach and having picnic there and, you know, taking our son for a little swim in the super clear water. It was just, it was an incredible special day. I think it was actually Father's Day from memory.
I think it was actually.
Yeah. But yeah, just a brilliant way to see the area and get back into it and kind of reignite that love and passion for flying.
Awesome stuff. So I guess what's next on the agenda, do you reckon? Are you going to stick down the management path? Do you love that enough, or are you going to wait till your husband tells you that that we're moving to a different location and see what happens next? Or
no, we are signed, sealed, delivered, staying in Darwin, thanks. I love the management side of things. I probably am a bit of a control freak, so I love the diversity that that gives you. And, you know, I enjoy the HR and creating a team environment where it's positive and supportive and driving towards bettering the way things are done and how things are done and the machine itself and the training of a pilot and the standards of your operation. I really am passionate about how all of those things have to come together to keep driving a company forward. And so I think, I would like to think everybody in our company can see the difference from the start of where we were to where we are now, and hopefully where we'll be in another 5 years, 10 years down the track, with the overall quality and feel is the wrong word, but the overall happiness of all our staff and in everything that we do, it's a positive improvement on what's been before.
Yeah. Oh, I can definitely testament to that. It's a great place to work because of what you've done there and how you interact with everyone, and all the staff love working under you. And, you know, I think you've done a great job, and I'm certainly very proud of everything you've done throughout the whole career, not just in the Mallard part of things. You obviously have huge high standards and very driven and absolutely competent at what you do, which is, you know, it's a great motivation for me as well, which is, I think, why we're a great team, Jenna.
Well, thanks, Dan.
There you go. I really loved hearing more about your story. I hope everyone else loved hearing that as well. And I'd very much like to thank my wife, Jenna Bolton, for coming on The Step.
Pleasure. Thanks, Dan.
And that's the show for today, folks. Thanks so much to Jenna for finally coming on the podcast to share her story. And what a great story it is. Don't forget to review the show, folks. Share it to a friend or get in touch to say hello if you wish to do so. It's been a pleasure to share another story for you all again. And I'd like to say thanks to everyone for listening. And I look forward to sharing the next amazing seaplane story next time we get on The Step.